Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Activities. We report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience and also his remarks on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, where he criticised the media for its steady diet of news about evil, saying it hardens hearts and poisons our souls. Bethlehem Blues. We tap into the current situation and mood of the small Christian community in the town where Jesus was born and learn how the security barrier heavily restricts their daily lives and movements. And Advent Reflection. Father Matthew Gamba, a Jesuit priest and journalist, shares with us his insights into the meaning of Advent and his own childhood recollections of this pre-Christmas season. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figure of the 12th century theologian Rupert of Deutz in his catechesis. Emma McCarthy reports.
Today there is a danger that the Eucharist is being reduced to a social rite, where we forget too easily that Christ is present in a true, real and substantial way in the Eucharist. On Wednesday, Pope Benedict said this was also a danger in the Church of the Middle Ages, as seen in debates such as the Eucharistic controversy of 1077 that led to the condemnation of Berengar of Tours. But even though in the 12th century the doctrine of transubstantiation had not yet been formalized, there was a Benedictine monk from Belgium who had spelled it out in his writings. He was Rupert of Deutz, and this Wednesday's chapter on the great thinkers of the Church in the Middle Ages was entirely dedicated to him.
Rupert experienced at first hand the conflict between the empire and the church, linked to the investiture crisis, and he played a significant role in the principal theological debates of his day. He forcefully defended the reality of Christ's real presence in the Eucharist and insisted that the origin of evil is to be found in man's mistaken use of freedom, not in the positive will of God.
An intellectual of great depth and insight, Rupert covered many heated topics of his day, topics, noted Pope Benedict, that remained cause for debate centuries later in today's world. The separation of church and state, fidelity to the Petrine ministry and church teaching, the infinite goodness of God and the origin of evil in man himself and his misuse of human freedom. Pope Benedict also noted that Rupert was the first person to present Mary as the most exalted, best part of the church.
His teaching on the dignity and privileges of the Virgin Mary, presented within a broad ecclesiological context, would prove influential for later theology and find an echo in the doctrine of the Second Vatican Council.
His example, concluded Pope Benedict, inspires us to draw near to Christ, present among us in his word and in the Eucharist, and to rejoice in the knowledge that he remains with us at every moment of our lives and throughout history.
May God bless you all.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Grazie.
On Tuesday, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, Pope Benedict decried the media for its steady diet of news about evil in the world, saying it hardens our hearts and in a way poisons our souls. The Pope said the media ignored everyday acts of love and kindness and also accused it of exploiting people for profit. His remarks came during a ceremony in the square below Rome's Spanish Steps, where he paid homage to a statue of Our Lady, a papal tradition on this date. Chris Altieri has this report on the Pope's activities.
Pope Benedict XVI decried the steady diet of news about evil in the world yesterday in remarks at the traditional Immaculate Conception ceremony at the Spanish Steps, saying every day through the newspapers, television, radio, evil is reported, repeated, amplified, making us used to horrible things, making us become insensitive and in some way poisoning us. Pope Benedict spoke also of the sweet and reassuring presence that Mary brings to the heart of Christian cities everywhere, and how, with her unassuming style, she gives peace and hope to everyone in times of happiness and sadness.
L'anima mia, magnifica il Signore.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, nelle core delle città cristiane, Maria costituisce una presenza dolce e rassicurante.
The Pope also offered his special thanks to all those who work quietly to make the city of Rome a better place, and encouraged all the faithful to hear Mary's silent but pressing appeal. To each of us, said Pope Benedict, Mary asks that wherever sin has abounded, grace might abound all the more, starting with each faithful heart and life. And the city, said Pope Benedict, will be more beautiful, more Christian, more human.
Vergine Immacolata, Salus Populi Romani, prega per noi.
Earlier in the day, the Pope prayed the Angelus with the faithful gathered in St. Peter's Square for the traditional noonday prayer of Marian devotion on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception.
Cari amici, che gioia immensa avere per Madre Maria Immacolata.
What immense joy we have, dear friends, for Mother Mary Immaculate, said Pope Benedict. Whenever we experience our fragility and the suggestion of evil, we can turn to her and our heart receives light and comfort. The Pope urged everyone to remember, during the trials of life in which faith and hope are shaken, that we are her children and that the roots of our existence lie in the infinite grace of God.
Pensiamo che siamo figli suoi e che le radici della nostra esistenza affondano nell'infinita grazia di Dio.
The Church, the Pope added, although exposed to the negative influences of the world, finds always in Mary the star by which we might guide ourselves and follow the way that Christ has shown her. For Mary is the mother of the Church, as proclaimed by the Second Vatican Council. Finally, thanking God for the wonderful sign of his goodness, Pope Benedict entrusted each of us, our families and communities throughout the Church and the world, to the Immaculate Virgin.
Angelus Domini nuntiavit Mariae.
Concepite Spiritus Sancto.
After the Angelus prayer, Pope Benedict greeted the faithful in many languages, including English.
I am happy to greet all the English-speaking visitors present at this Angelus prayer. Today, we celebrate the Immaculate Conception of Mary, the Mother of Jesus, as we venerate her life of holiness, full of grace from the beginning of her existence. We praise God and acclaim the power of his gifts. May all Christians, filled with joyful hope and following the example of Mary, be faithful to God's grace and seek a life of holiness.
I'm Chrysol Thierry.
Bethlehem is the birthplace of Jesus. And as Christmas approaches, our thoughts turn to this small town in the Holy Land, where the Christian message began. But 2,000 years after that momentous nativity, how many Christians are still living in the town where Jesus was born? Once a majority Christian town, Bethlehem has seen the number of Christians living there steadily dwindle, and this is a pattern repeated across the rest of the Holy Land. Some fear that if this emigration of Christians continues at its present rate, there could be no resident community of Christians left in the Holy Land within a few generations. The separation barrier between Israel and the Palestinian territories has hit Bethlehem particularly hard by effectively cutting off easy access to and from the nearby city of Jerusalem. The restrictions on movements caused by the separation barrier, together with the Israeli military checkpoints, the economic blockade, high unemployment, and the ongoing stalemate in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, are all factors encouraging Palestinian Christians to turn their back on their native land. And these same factors also discourage pilgrims from coming to see the holy sites. Brother Peter Bray is the Vice-Chancellor of Bethlehem University, a Catholic institute of higher learning open to students of all faith traditions. He spoke to me about the current mood of Bethlehem's inhabitants in this Advent season and the daily difficulties they have to endure.
Well, I think Bethlehem is such a special place, and the reason it's special is because of Christmas. And so there is a sense of anticipation, I suppose, as Christmas approaches, and the festive lights are going up around Bethlehem, along the power lines, along the power poles, and around houses and streets and whatever. And so even though the Christians are a minority here, the Christmas season is a really, really important season for the town. And so there's an obvious build-up of anticipation as Christmas does approach.
But is there a lot of unemployment and hardship, because of course the impact of the security barrier makes travelling between Bethlehem and Jerusalem all but impossible for some people, and extremely very difficult. Can you tell us a little bit about how families are managing to cope?
Well, unemployment is a real issue here in Bethlehem. Prior to the apartheid wall going up, the people from Bethlehem used to be able to go into Jerusalem and find employment there. Now, for people to get employment in Jerusalem, they have to have a special permit, which isn't easy to get. And then they have to line up to go through the security wall and through the checkpoints. And often that's 3-4 o'clock in the morning, they have to go and line up there. So a lot of people are unemployed here in Bethlehem. One of the things that has happened is over the last few years, the number of pilgrims coming to Bethlehem has increased. Up until Christmas of last year, that was generally building. And then, of course, we had the Gaza debacle, and people associated the destruction of Gaza with the Middle East. And so through January, February, March, really, of last year, there's a huge fall-off of pilgrims coming to Bethlehem, and that had a very serious impact. In the latter part of this year, that is improving, and there have been, over the last few months, an increase in the number of pilgrims. And with people coming into Bethlehem, the pilgrim or tourist trade is a very, very important part of the economy here. So if people are coming, then it's better off for people who are here. And there are very limited opportunities for people to gain employment here in Bethlehem. So there are a lot of families who are struggling, and particularly if there's a fall-off in pilgrims coming into the place. So there are a lot of NGOs and church institutions that are helping people who are struggling. But, you know, I'm under no illusion that, say, people in some of the refugee camps are very, very poor. There's no doubt whatsoever about that.
You talked there about the impact of the security barrier. I mean, it's not just on the visitors who come in, but of course on the inhabitants as well. But looking at the visitors, first of all, as we were talking about the importance of getting pilgrims coming, how much do they have to queue? I mean, how sort of laborious is it to go through the security barrier?
Well, it depends. Most of the pilgrims come in buses. Now, I came back from Jerusalem two nights ago around about 5:30, and there would have been probably 12 buses and probably 30 or 40 cars lined up on the Bethlehem side of the wall waiting to go through. Now, I don't think any of the pilgrim buses have any difficulty in getting through once they get to the checkpoint. But see, they would be waiting there half an hour, three quarters of an hour, get through the barrier. Now, some of the the tour operators are unhappy about that, because it's a loss for them, because it means they can't go to the other places that they were intending. And so one of the difficulties that can arise from this is that tour operators will avoid Bethlehem because they don't want to go through the hassle of going through the checkpoint. Then that affects the people here in Bethlehem. So one of the things that I find irritating, I suppose, is the nonchalant way in which the soldiers at the checkpoint treat people. They don't care about the fact that there's a huge line of cars and buses waiting. It's not helpful to tour operators in the way in which that's done.
And when it comes to inhabitants who, of course, have to put up with it on a daily basis, I mean, do you hear a lot of grumbles about it, and what sort of time is wasted? How long does it take, for instance, nowadays to get from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, which is only about 8 miles, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it varies on the time of day and how many people are there. Sometimes it's taken me 20 minutes. Other times it's taken me over an hour to get through. And I had a function at Notre Dame earlier in the year, and I allowed myself an hour. I had to be there at 5:30. I left home at 4:30. I was still about 20 cars from the checkpoint at 5:20, and I was supposed to be in Notre Dame at 5:30. So it depends. Some of our employees here, one man who worked at Bethlehem University for 24 years and lived in East Jerusalem, and sometimes he could come through in 20 minutes, quarter hour. Sometimes it could take him 2 hours, and that's one of the reasons he left here. But people who are working in Jerusalem, who have to walk through which is a different checkpoint to the ones the cars go through, they can be waiting there for 2 or 3 hours to get through. In particular, if they're Palestinians, they're treated with a lot more suspicion than expats from other countries. For the Palestinian people, the whole experience of going through the checkpoint is a degrading one and often a humiliating one. And I have to say that one of the things I have found most distressing for Palestinian Muslim men, one of the important things for them is the standing and the respect they have from their family. And I have seen men being humiliated in front of their children by Israeli soldiers who are young enough to be their son. And I'm wondering, what must that do inside that man to realize that he's being humiliated by this young soldier in front of his children? It just seems to me such if they want to make security an issue, which I think it's way out of proportion, but if they want to make it, okay, but treat people with dignity, not humiliate them and embarrass them in front of their children.
So would it be fair to say there's an awful lot of resentment against this security wall and people are not just sort of getting used to it and now have given up on any hope of trying to get the Israelis lift some of these restrictions or make it speedier to get through?
Well, their experience has taught them to be careful, because I've heard stories about people in cars coming to the checkpoint and being having to wait, and then a whole series of them hooting their horns, and the Israeli soldiers have just walked away and sat down and wouldn't let anybody through. The thing is that Israel has absolute control politically, economically and military, and the Palestinians, how do you counter that? How do you counter the fifth strongest army in the world with nothing? The Palestinians really don't have any way of countering that. And that's why, for us here at Bethlehem University, one of the things that we've become very aware of is that Palestinians are investing in education. Because of all of the things that Palestinians have, education is the thing that the Israelis can't take away from them. And so that's what they're investing in. And that's why Bethlehem University has such an important role here in Bethlehem, and particularly for the Christians here in the Middle East or in Palestine.
But what kind of jobs do your students get when they graduate? Because as you said earlier, there's a lot of unemployment. How easy is it for them to get a job, and how many of them end up going abroad?
Well, it depends on what they've studied. For example, most of our nurses, people who graduate from our nursing faculty, get jobs. Most of our teachers who graduate from the Faculty of Education get jobs. Most of the people who graduate from our Institute of Hotel Management get jobs. The difficulty is people who graduate from the Faculty of Science or some parts of the Faculty of Arts, and people who graduate from the Faculty of Business, I'd have to say, lose a lot of people from the Faculty of Business after they graduate down to the Gulf. Some of them also go into Jordan. But unemployment is a real issue. There's no doubt about it. And because Israel controls the economy of Palestine, in some ways there's very little that the Palestinians can do about it.
A lot has been said about the fact that Christians are emigrating from the Holy Land, that a percentage of Christians living there has gone down drastically over the last 40 or so years. Are Christians continuing to leave? Are people very worried about this trend?
Oh, yes, I think there is a real concern about it. One of the things that I think it's important to keep in mind is that while there are still some Christians immigrating, the important thing, I think, to remember is raw numbers. See, one of the things that is happening is that the Muslim population here in Palestine are having much bigger families than Christian people, and the percentage of Muslims is growing.
But, I mean, people there mostly still believe that there can still be, in a generation's time, a viable Christian community?
Well, I think that's the case, that people do believe that, you know, there are Christians who are moving back to Bethlehem and back to Palestine because this is where their roots are. I was speaking to somebody just recently who was saying that they'd been in the United States, I think, for something like 7 years, and they missed their family, they missed their culture, they missed Bethlehem. Because there's something really special about being here where it all started.
I was speaking to Brother Peter Bray of Bethlehem University. Christmas is approaching, and this season of Advent, preceding Christianity's most joyful celebration, the birth of the baby Jesus, is a time of waiting, preparation, prayer, and reflection. The word Advent comes from the Latin for coming, and Christians everywhere are waiting to celebrate Christ's coming here on earth. Father Matthew Gamba is a Jesuit priest and journalist, and he shares with us his insights into the importance and meaning of Advent and his own childhood recollections of this pre-Christmas season.
Yes, it's one of my absolute favorite seasons of the year, not just because of the Christmas, but it really gives us that opportunity to think about and to prepare for the coming of the Lord, but also to think about how he's already here and to be a little bit more mindful of his presence among us in the world today.
Advent is, of course, as I said, a period of waiting, of preparation. And yet we live such busy lives and society is so frenetic. Do we sometimes find it difficult to stop and look around and look for Christ?
I think that's absolutely the case. And yet, it's really a gift from God to us, you know, that we don't just sort of all of a sudden stumble on Christmas morning. Okay, it's here. It helps us to prepare gradually, little by little, day by day. We live our regular lives, but there's something deeper going on if we'll pay attention to it. And I think that's what the Lord is calling us to during this time. It goes awfully fast, just a few weeks, really. And yet, during that time, it seems like the busiest time of the year, and yet it's also meant to be one of the more spiritual times. So it's always a balancing act.
I found an Advent reflection written by Pope Benedict when he was still Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. It dates back, in fact, to the 1980s. I'll read it to you, and maybe you can comment on it. Advent is concerned with that very connection between memory and hope, which is so necessary to man. Advent's intention is to awaken the most profound and basic emotional memory within us, namely the memory of the God who became a child. This is a healing memory. It brings hope. The purpose of the Church's year is continually to rehearse her great history of memories, to awaken the heart's memory so that it can discern the star of hope. It is the beautiful task of Advent to awaken in all of us memories of goodness and thus to open doors of hope.
Hope is always such a constant theme in his old writings, but in his current writings and during his pontificate, that message of hope, because I think maybe he sees the world as losing hope or not being really imbued with a lot of hope. And the coming of God as a baby is a sign of great hope. I think whenever we see a little infant or a child, we think of the future and we think of the great things that can happen to this child and the hope, you know, that that phrase, you know, when the birth of every child is God's promise that he's not finished with the world. So I find that it is definitely a season of hope and a preparation of joy, but he's drawing on the memories probably of our own childhood, our own infancies, our own preparations for Christmas can be a touchstone to help us in our Advent journeys.
As we know, Christmas is a time of goodwill when we try to look around and not forget those who are less fortunate than ourselves. Is there any way in which you try to put this into practice?
I do a couple of things every year. One is the recommendation of a priest that I knew about 15 years ago. He said, pick one person with whom you would like to be better reconciled, somebody that you're maybe on the outs with or you've had difficulty with, and make that person a constant part of your prayer life each and every day, and just see how the Lord perhaps heals that relationship, strengthens that relationship, opens it up a little bit more, maybe to a true and full reconciliation. And it happens all the time, and I recommend this to people. And during this Advent season, it's a time of reconciliation, of preparing for the coming of the Lord. So
you still carry on this yes, every Advent.
Right. And I have somebody in mind that I'm praying for that we need to have a deeper reconciliation as well. In terms of reaching out to other people, absolutely. We do, in my family traditionally, a lot of charitable work, and especially supporting our missionaries in other parts of the world and trying to collect money and sending things to them so that they can continue to preach the good news.
Now, talking about preaching the good news, a lot of the gospel readings in the Advent season are based around the account of St. John the Baptist, who preaches the coming of the Lord. Can you tell us a little bit about the figure of St. John the Baptist, his message? He's quite an uncomfortable figure. He's quite an anti-conformist figure in a way, and he's got quite uncomfortable news. He's not implying it's all going to be milk and honey, is he?
Well, no. He says, I am the voice of the one crying out in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord. Notice he says he's the voice of the one crying out. So he really is God's chosen instrument, and his message is, you know, straighten things out. So he's pretty honest. He holds the mirror up to us.
Now, is there any personal anecdote that you can share with us that for you summed up for you why Advent is so important, or why for you it is such a joyful season, or just any particular aspect?
For us, back to my home in Chicago, was the Advent wreath that we had every single year on our big table. I was one of six children and my parents, so eight of us every night at dinner, lighting that Advent calendar, Advent wreath, and saying a special prayer. And of course, it was always kind of a battle who gets to do it tonight, and my mom trying to, you know, divvy it up among us, and we never played with matches except during lighting the Advent wreath. So that was such a special season, and it just changed the daily kitchen table into a place of something special, something prayerful and something joyful. And then it was so simple in a way, and then at the end of Advent, a month later, the whole house is full of the joy of Christmas. But we really tried to observe Advent season as a time of prayer and preparation as a family. And I encourage families to do that too. The Advent wreath is something so simple. Children just love it, and it just draws attention. And right in the middle of the normal family life can be a place where we are experiencing the Lord and one another.
Did you also have an Advent calendar, which is very popular,
yes,
another popular tradition in the run-up to Christmas?
Absolutely. We had a beautiful Advent calendar of definitely religious themes. It was kind of the nativity, and we'd open the doors each day again. It was like each child got a special turn for it. I'm the one now who buys the Advent calendars for all my nieces and nephews and make sure that they keep up that tradition in their families as well. So Advent calendar, Advent wreath, definitely. And then our parish had a wonderful, every year they send out like a CD or a tape that had little thoughts for the day from the pastor that we could play in the home as well.
Another, of course, fundamental tradition during the lead up to Christmas, during Advent, is the nativity scene, the creche scene. Was that also a very important part of your own life?
Yes, we always had that creche scene under the tree, and little by little we'd move the shepherds and the sheep and the figures closer and closer to the Christmas tree and to the stable that final night, Christmas Eve, putting the baby Jesus in there as well. But these things came a little bit later in Advent. We try to keep these first few weeks a more quiet time, more prayerful time.
I was speaking to Jesuit priest Father Matthew Gamba.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.